nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so things we have been discussing in the last few classes, I tried to summarize in a sheet. I think I emailed it to you. Also handed out a hard copy. So you have the essential equations. This is, of course, not a set of notes that kind of stands by itself. It's like together with the lectures and all to possibly help with supplementing what you have. Just a summary. Now, what I want to do is say make a few more comments about what we were doing and then go on to related this next topic, which is called the scattering theory of transport. I want to explain that. But so before I get started on that, regarding what we are doing then, just to remind you, the basic point I was trying to get across that's important is that, see, when you think of current flow in any structure, the equation you write for conductance, you know, you usually think of voltage is equal to resistance times current, and the resistance is this conductivity, width over length. The thing is that usually the expressions you use see for conductivity is not this one, but you see something like Qn times what you call mobility. This is what is most commonly seen in the literature. This, because this is easy to understand. You have a bunch of electrons, you put a voltage, because of that the electrons start moving, they acquire a certain drift velocity, and hence this is the current, etc. Now, what's confusing about this one, the reason it doesn't take you very far, is that when you look at this, you think that conductivity depends on the total number of electrons. And that, as I've said quite a few times, is that things that are insulating are really not insulating because they don't have electrons. No matter what material we talk about, there's lots of electrons. The real reason why something doesn't conduct very well is not that they don't have electrons, but they don't have electrons around the chemical potential. And this point of view kind of loses that. Whereas, if you look at it from, the more general expression that you'll see is that conductivity is not this, but I mean, this is, instead of this, the more correct expression is the following, where it is dE minus del F del E times sigma. So as if at every energy, if you can think of a conductivity for electrons with that energy, and then it is averaged over energy according to this function. And this function, as I've mentioned often, it's a something that is peaked right around the electrochemical potential. And so when you think of it from this point of view, you see that what really contributes to conductivity and current flow is the density of states, electrons, etc., around the chemical potential. And at low temperatures, this del F del E is actually a delta function. So you can essentially forget about the integral and just look at this exactly at the Fermi energy, whatever that is. As long as the temperature is low. And if the temperature is not low, then you have to do this averaging. Okay. Now, from that point of view, of course, you'd say, okay, so the conductance is really density of states times V squared. Now, how do I reconcile that with this? Because here, this is total number of electrons. This, on the other hand, is density of states right around the chemical potential. This is D of E. And the way you kind of reconcile the two is by noting that this V squared is like energy, because half mv squared is like energy. So usually if you have a density of states looking like this, this is energy, and your chemical potential is somewhere here, then this half mv squared is something like this energy, that much. And so density of states times energy, that essentially becomes something like the total number of electrons. Of course, it's not exact. This would be exact if the density of states were constant. Then you'd say, okay, it's a constant density of states times that energy, that's the total number of electrons. But what you can show, and this I'll ask you to do in your next homework, I'll explain how to do it, is that this is exactly true, that this dE times V square, you could equate to the total number of electrons up to that energy, actually, as long as this this density of states has a simple form. It goes to zero, it follows some power law, which is usually the case with a single band thing. On the other hand, one of the materials we are very interested in these days is something called graphene, where, as I mentioned, the EK diagram looks something like this. So when you look at the density of states, it's like increases. I mean, this is where the chemical potential is, and the density of states increases either way. Now, if your chemical potential is somewhere here, then the conductivity really depends on how many electrons you have in this much range. On the other hand, if you really think it's all electrons, then there's no good reason not to count all the electrons down here, for example. Really. But of course, no one believes that's true. I mean, everyone counts it from here. It's just that from this point of view, there is no good reason why you count from here. You see? And same with the Hall effect. The Hall effect, that what you get for the Hall effect, you know, this thing that we talked about, again, you can equate it to 1 over qn, but then n meaning which electrons? Is it this much or is it all? And of course, the correct answer is this much. You see? Anyway, so the bottom line is, the reason I was kind of going through all this is that in the literature, there's these two ways of looking at conductivity that you'll see. One that says conductivity is proportional to the total number of electrons. The other, which will involve this dE, del F, del E. This one is easy to derive. This is the one that usually is derived from the Boltzmann equation. And in these notes, I gave you the reference to Professor Lundstrom's book that you can look at, where it's actually derived from the Boltzmann equation, you know, which requires a lot of discussion. And as we know, we have a course 656, which is essentially about the Boltzmann equation and its application to devices, actually. So I didn't really want to go into that in this course. What I tried to do instead was give you a relatively simpler explanation for why, what the expression, where expressions like this come from. And that is where I'm using this Landauer point of view, which is that, okay, current flows because electrons, you know, the left contact wants to fill it up, right contact wants to take it out, and so the current is proportional to F1 minus F2. And then if you do a Taylor series expansion, you'll get a del F del E times that. And so you immediately see why current has a del F depends on this rather than F. That's the point. Okay? But this is a very important point that causes lots of confusion and debate. That is it all the electrons? And if so, which ones? And the answer is not really. Finally, current flow always depends on those energies where this is sizable. Really. Okay. Now, what we did last couple of days was I was trying to get an expression for voltage and the Hall voltage for a given current flow. So you have a current flowing this way due to a voltage applied across the device, and the Hall voltage develops in this direction. And when we found this, of course, we are thinking of one energy, single energy. Now, if you want to add up all the energies, then at the end of the day, you need to put an integral this in front of it. You have to sum up all the energies. Now, this is where there's a slightly tricky point, which is what I wanted to mention before we go on, and that's this. That you might say that, well, I could just do this and put an integral dE, you know, the sum over all energies. But that wouldn't be quite right, because you see, all these energies are in parallel. They kind of have the same voltage, but not the same current. So when you add them, you add currents. You need to invert this and write currents in terms of voltages. You have to turn this around before you sum it up. And so what you have to do is, the way we did this, when I arrived at this expression, the understanding was that there is no current in the x direction or in the Hall direction. There's zero current in this way. Now, in principle, of course, you could have done a Hall current measurement, not a Hall. I mean, what people always do is Hall voltage, normally. They measure the voltage, not the current. But in principle, you could be measuring current. Voltages are easier to measure because usually it doesn't depend on contact resistance. If you didn't have a bad contact, you'd still get a good reading for the voltage, but the current could get reduced a lot. That's it. Anyway, but you could be measuring a Hall current, for example. And so a more general expression would have been V depends on I as well as the IH. Similarly, a VH depends on I as well as IH. And then you can invert the whole thing and say, okay, I have I and IH. Take this out here. Then you could invert this whole thing and write IIH is equal to something times VVH. And once you have this, you could then do the integral dE minus del F del E. Because what we have here would give you the current at a given energy. All the energy channels are in parallel. Just add them up. That's fine. It's just that you can't do it here. Because when you complete this thing, it would look something like this. What I mean by that is, last couple of days, what we have been discussing is about this first column. First column, you see, I'm writing this in the form of a matrix. So it's like V is equal to this times I plus this times IH. IVH equals this times I, this times IH. Now, what we did in the last couple of days was we said, okay, let's assume IH is equal to 0 and see what is the corresponding Hall voltage. That's how we came up with this and this. That was it. Now, in principle, we could have talked about a current that flows in the x direction. I called this z and this x. So, in principle, I could have talked about current flow in the x direction and looked at the corresponding voltage, and that would then look just like that, except that the role of W and L would be reversed, because here, what was length, here W is kind of the length. So it would have been reversed here. That's all. And the Hall direction gets turned around also, because it's like from here, when you apply a magnetic field, let's say it turns around this way and wants to develop a voltage here. When you come in from here, it wants to turn around that way, and the voltage is in the opposite direction. So if you go through that carefully, you'd see that there should be a minus sign there. But basically, the same type of thing. Now, why do I have to include this in the thinking? Because you see, what we did in our discussion was put that equal to 0. And you say, well, in the end, of course, I'm still going to be measuring Hall voltage. So Hall current is 0, actually, eventually. But it's just that Hall current is not necessarily 0 energy by energy. When you actually put in a probe here and measure the Hall voltage across this, the total current has to be 0, of course, but not necessarily at every energy. At some energies, you could have something going out, wanting to go out, but at other energies, it comes back in, so the total is 0. Because, you see, that the Hall voltage that is needed to make this 0 is generally different at different energies, because this factor here is different at different energies. So at one energy, you might have a Hall voltage that wants to be, say, 2 millivolts. Another one, it wants to be 3 millivolts in order to make the current 0 at that energy. And eventually what will happen is it will come to some average, some average which is more than what it needs to be at certain energies and less than what it needs to be at certain energies. And so at different energies, you'll have a little bit of current going back and forth. Anyway, the bottom line is that that is why you cannot just take that much average over energy and say you are done. I mean, you won't be very wrong, but it won't be quite right. That's all. And so the right way of doing it would be that just the arguments that we went through to fill this up, do a similar argument with the z and x directions reversed and fill that up. And now you have voltages in terms of currents. There's a matrix here, which you could invert. And if you invert it, then you'll have currents in terms of voltages. And what you have here then, you could call sigma zz w over L, sigma zz w over L. This would be like sigma zx. This would be like sigma xz. And what you see in the literature is expressions for these sigma zz, sigma zx. The reference I gave to Professor Lundstrom's book, you could look at the expressions that are actually obtained, which is exactly what we get also. So I want to show you. And the point is, of course, that these expressions, which are derived from this proper transport theory, will always have del f del e in it and not the total number of electrons. That's the point. And so conduction and all that really depends on the situation right around the chemical potential, not on everything down there. That's important. Okay. Now, the next topic I wanted to get on to, that's what we'll get started today and possibly finish up on Monday, and that has to do with a very useful way of looking at current flow that's used a lot, especially in the context of small devices. And that has to do with, you see, the way we discuss this here, you know, we are talking about how electrons come in from here, and this is like the occupation of the positive going states. This is the occupation of the negative going states. This is z equals 0, z equals L, and gradually it goes down, this goes up, etc. And based on that, the expression for current that we had you have these two factors here. One's here, one's this. And where do they come from? If you remember, this factor is like density of states times velocity. And this is what I said you could interpret as the number of lanes on your highway. That how many channels are carrying the current. That's what this one is. And one of the things we'll talk about as we get into quantum transport is that in small devices, people find that this can actually be written as some integer divided by Planck's constant. This was, of course, not anticipated at all and was discovered about 20 years back, that in small devices, yeah, this actually becomes quantized. Okay? Okay. But in this discussion then, yeah, we can just, I'll just call it M over H, where M is like the number of modes. And how do you think about M? Well, it's like density of states times velocity. So basically, yeah. So in a way, I think of it as the channels on your highway. Now, what's this factor? That factor has to, you know, the way we got this, if you remember, was by solving this equation and saying that this is mu 1, this is mu 2, but the current is actually this difference. This difference between how many are going plus and how many are going minus. And what we said was that this, which is the same as this, is parallel everywhere. Goes the same. It's actually lambda over lambda plus L of the total voltage. And that's how we came up with this. So lambda over lambda plus L times the total voltage is like this difference. This difference which tells you how much more occupied the northbound lanes are compared to the southbound lanes. Okay? That's it. Okay. Now, another way of thinking about this factor is you could call it the transmission probability. So again, if you think of as cars, it's like there's say 1,000 cars that start out from here, from the south end, let's say Lafayette. Question is how many actually get to Chicago? Because on the way, a lot of them turn around and go back. So how many actually get there? And the point is, how many get there is this factor. So if the total distance is, say, 10 mean free paths long, then how many will get there? Well, 1/11th will get there, if it's 10. If it's 100 mean free paths long, 1 over 101 will get there. That's the basic idea. Yeah. Yeah, this is the thing that I'm trying to leave the electric fields out of the discussion. But yeah, the point I had made before is that these mu's tell you the occupation of the states, right? And there is the bottom of the band here, which is EC. That's the bottom of the band. And if there's an electric field, that is reflected in a slope of this. So what I'm trying to say is that you have states here, they are occupied or not, and that has no particular relation to the electric field necessarily. So you could have an electric field like this, or you may not have any. Yeah. Right. This is the part that I'm trying to say that, yeah, the way you usually learn it is what drives current is electric field. And this is the point I'm saying is really not right. You know, one example you know, of course, PN junction, enormous electric field, no current if it's sitting there. One good example, right? So electric field is not what drives current. Because another problem you have when you think in terms of electric field is, if electric field drives current, then you should really include all the electrons. No good reason to say that only the electrons around the Fermi energy matter. Right? After all, if there's an electric field, everything feels it, kind of, you could say. And yet, the thing is that the current flow really is only around the chemical potential. Because finally, what really drives current is this difference in Fs. Namely, I have a region here where F is, say, 1, and a region here where F is, say, 0.9. What is F? It just tells me what fraction of these states is occupied. What fraction is occupied? It doesn't matter how many electrons you have. I mean, current doesn't flow because you have 100 electrons here and 90 electrons there. No. Current flows because the fraction of states occupied here is bigger than the fraction of states occupied there. Just as heat doesn't flow because there is more heat someplace, it's because the temperature is higher. And temperature is sort of like the amount of heat per degree of freedom, etc. So it's a similar concept, but all I'm saying is that what really drives current is this F. And unfortunately, the only place where this comes in a transport theory is if you actually get to Boltzmann equation, which, you know, is a hard thing, you know, it requires some time to get into and all that. And normally you say, well, yeah, current is driven by electric field. Well, not quite. And in this context, the point I made is that imagine a situation where somehow I made the mu's different but didn't really put an electric field. So EC is flat. You'd still have a current. No question. Now, in practice, of course, this wouldn't be a kind of stable situation, because if you keep the EC fixed and lower the mu, you have too few electrons here. So this region would want to get positively charged as a result. Unless, of course, this is a region that was lightly doped so that that keeps it neutral. But otherwise, what would happen is it would be positively charged. And so when you solve it self-consistently with Poisson equation, you'll find that it goes down somewhat. Now, because of this electric field, would the current increase? Possibly a little bit if we are talking of large electric fields. Possibly a little bit because the electrons here previously had only that much velocity. Now they have that much velocity. And because it's that much velocity, its conductivity goes up because, as you know, conductivity is density of states times velocity square. So I think the current would go up a little bit. But then we are talking of small voltages here. We are talking essentially of low bias, in which case this makes no difference really.
In the long device where we can think of little lambda devices in series. You argued that we can have this factor of two just before the L. You probably remember we had this discussion about this. If you have two devices in series, where to put the factor of two, yeah?
Two meaning the lambda. This lambda plus L part,
yeah, exactly.
Right? That's the part, yeah. Right.
So, and if we have so many in series, and then an electric field comes into place, we have energy dissipation. So if an electron wants to turn around, there is a potential barrier it has to overcome. Let's say we have 10 small lambda devices in series, it passed already 5, and we have a potential drop, and then after 5 devices, it likes to turn around and wants to go back.
Right. Now, the way most people, this description that we are going through, most people usually apply it to just one Landauer device, right? And what I tried to show, use it to show you why in big devices also you get this, and you get the standard answers that you normally get from more complicated methods starting from Boltzmann equation, right? That's what I tried to show you. But that's usually not standard. It's not, people usually don't quite apply it to big devices. So, to me, the part that I'm relatively sure and you can do easily is when you have a big device, consider a small section of it and apply this. Right? And then the question comes up that, well, if you had two of these in series, question is, what I tried to point out last day is that if you just add this resistance to that resistance, you're kind of implying that in between there is actually a contact. And if you take, and if this really doesn't exist except in your mind, in other words, if the real thing is like this, then you are adding an extra contact resistance, because there is a resistance associated with going from 10 channels to 10,000 channels. And if that didn't happen, then you shouldn't include it. So those are the issues of how, and those are the subtleties that you have to be careful about when you are putting them in series. But in this discussion, I'm saying, let's just think of one of these Landauer devices, and that's what you're talking about.
So didn't you say it's L is energy relaxation time, not momentum relaxation time?
Right. So this length should be a whole lot less than the energy relaxation time. So whatever we are talking about, it can be many mean-free paths long, and mean-free path has to do with momentum relaxation. Because momentum relaxation means that somebody who was going to Chicago kind of turned around and came back. Well, energy relaxation is like you could even be in the same lane, just slow down somewhat. So those are the two separate issues. Right? So here it's like it's many, I said, you know, it are 100 mean free paths long. But mean free path is defined by how far you go before you change your mind and start going south. That's it.
Only a fraction of the electron density that is in the vicinity of the electrochemical potential participates in the conduction. I've heard an argument of a shifted sphere, and I wanted to ask how this argument is related to this discussion.
Yeah, sometimes people use the argument that okay, now the rigorous argument I'm saying is just that the basic expression for conductivity that you'd get from this point of view is d times v square, which you could write as d times e divided by m, in the sense that energy is like half m v square. So if you have half v square, you could write it that way. And then if you interpret d times e as the total electron, number of electrons, then you'd get expression like this. Except that this isn't necessarily true always. This is true if you have a density of states that looks, say, like this, or some simple power law, e to the power alpha. Which is in a single band case, usually it would have some simple power law like this. And in that case, d times e is like the total number of electrons. And you could equate the two. Right? Now, the other argument sometimes people make is that at the Fermi energy, let's say you have 20 electrons, which are all moving with the velocity at that energy, which is like, so you have, say, 20 electrons here moving with this velocity. And instead, you could think of it as if 20,000 electrons are moving at only a thousandth of that velocity. And the thousandth of that velocity is what you're calling the drift velocity. So I'm saying that the correct view is that 20 electrons are moving with a velocity appropriate at that energy. That's what gives you the current. And sometimes people say, well, but instead you could say that it's not these 20 that are moving very fast that carries the current. It's actually 20,000 of them, I mean all of this, but they're moving a whole lot slower. And that's the drift velocity. That's what you get by multiplying mobility with the applied field, right? Though, as I keep saying, it really shouldn't be field. One should look at gradient of the chemical potential. Okay. So that is fine. It's just that the 20,000 is somewhat arbitrary in the sense that if you have a density of states that looks like this and doesn't quite go to zero here, then the question is, should I stop here or should I also include these? So instead of 20,000, you could make it 20 million, and then you'd have to cut down the velocity. All that seems somewhat arbitrary. Whereas the basic thing itself is pretty simple, really. It's just getting complicated by all this. Basic thing is just that current flows because there's states right around the chemical potential. How much current do you get? Well, it's density of states times velocity square. And you see perfect. I mean, it's perfectly clear, which is getting complicated because of all the other baggage that we bring to this. Okay. And so the electric field issue also then, what I meant to say is that especially when you go to high bias and all that, yes, the electric fields have to be considered because, as I said, you could ask yourself the question that if I had one device whose EC was here and another device B whose EC was like this, but they both had the same profile of mu, question is, would they have the same current? And the answer is B would actually have a little more current, simply because an electron here now has a lot more velocity. And that should be taken into account and when you're doing a high bias calculation especially. But when you're trying to just understand the linear resistance, you know, I was there, I think it doesn't matter whether it's this or that. And the basic thing driving a current is really, again, is the difference in the mu's. It's because one electron states in one part are more occupied than states in the other part. That's really it.
Yes. This device is, the device we are considering now is made up of many lambdas. So the Lindauer device is a ballistic device. That means it should be lesser than one lambda, momentum relaxation lambda.
Ballistic, no, Landauer device, I'm saying, you could do it a more generally, that even if you have lots of scattering, but as long as there's no energy relaxation, you could still treat it this way. You could still think of it this way. So I'm really, if it was ballistic, this picture would have looked like this. I mean, it would have just mu1, mu plus, minus. This is like northbound and southbound, no way to get from one to the other. So northbound states are filled according to how many get on from here. Southbound states are filled from according to how many get on from there. That's it. But I'm really but I'm applying it to something where it's like this. And right. And this is kind of useful because most devices are seldom fully ballistic. So usually lots of devices we are talking about, they're not like millions of mean free path long, but they're maybe 5 or 10 mean free paths long. That's the kind of device that you're often dealing with these days. Most experiments that you're measuring, that's really like that.
It was a little bit confusing because Lindauer proposed the device for ballistic. He did not go for a scattering model. He just had a model that was ballistic. It was smaller than one lambda probably.
Over the years, though, it has kind of evolved. But yeah, so the thing is that this is what people call say, transmission probability. And the Landauer formula is that conductance is Q square over H times the number of modes times transmission. That's really the Landauer formula. So transmission doesn't have to be one for ballistic, But if you have a region that is of length L and the mean free path is lambda, then this is what you'd call transmission. This basically tells you that if 1,000 cars start out, how many get to the other end? What fraction? What fraction get to the other end? Yeah.
So I'm just trying to understand this. So if we compare A and D,
A and B.
And if we apply the theory that we learn in 6 or 6, so we would say that in A, there is like a dn by dx, right? Because EC is fixed, and therefore there's a diffusion current. And for B, there's a drift current because of the diffusion. So how would you comment on that? As in, is that my perspective?
So with respect to the 606 theory then, what I'd say is in 606, what you learn is you have this sigma E, and then there is the diffusion coefficient dn dx. But what you also discuss there, I think, is that these two could be combined to write sigma d mu dx. That you see. So what I would say is that this is more fundamental, and usually you should go this way. So when you run into a funny situation like, let's say, effective mass is changing or density of states is changing, how then again what people do is they start from here, and then when they get here they find there are 3 or 4 more terms in there. So in my mind, this is the fundamental one, and if you get to a new situation, this is where you start. Whereas unfortunately, I think a lot of times you think of this as being fundamental and this just being an incidental thing. But what I'd say is that, yeah, current won't flow if mu is the same everywhere. That's really all we are sure of. And electric fields in general, because in 606 you are assuming there is always lots of inelastic scattering, so you are continuously losing energy. And this point I mentioned last day, that because of that, in big devices, people are used to thinking more in terms of electric field. So when does an insulator break down? When the electric fields exceed some breakdown field. Now if you look at your, as I said, the transistors you have in your laptop, and you look at how much field is actually being applied across an oxide, it is much higher than the breakdown field. But it doesn't break down because the voltage is really very small. We are talking of something that's only 1 or 2 nanometers thick. And in that case, the field is really not very relevant. It's only when there's big thing. This is the point I tried to make. So in general, for small devices, it's better to think in voltage rather than field. Okay. Now, one of the issues that came up in small devices, and this is what sort of motivated this scattering theory of transport that I want to talk about like today and Monday, and that is that when you actually make measurements, you know, the way we are thinking here is there is some chemical potential here, and how do you measure things? Well, you could put a probe here, for example. So probe means, these days, the simplest way of getting a non-invasive probe, you know, something that doesn't change what you're measuring, would be an STM. So you could bring an STM down here, and you could see what voltage you have to apply to it in order to null out the current, so that no current actually flows. And that will happen when the STM has exactly the same chemical potential as what you are trying to measure. Okay? And so usually people think, okay, that's a measurement detail. As long as I know how the mu varies, I know what the measurement should give me. Except that if the probe is not non-invasive, if it's invasive, so let's say it's not an STM, but you actually put in some kind of a probe there. And this is a very small thing, like a carbon nanotube. Then the thing is, just the presence of the probe changes this completely. Because an electron coming in here suddenly hits the probe and finds that there's a big reflection. And so right there, there's a huge reflection. And so that, of course, immediately drops this. So the probe itself is hard to make it completely non-invasive. Although these days with STM, you can make it quite good. But say 10, 15 years ago, it was much harder. And most of the measurements were with invasive probes. And so the question was, how do you interpret experiments like that? Because if you just calculate this, means nothing, because when you put the probe in, this picture has changed completely. Okay. Then the other issue that came up was that, well, depending on the construction of the probe, you might end up measuring this, or some linear combination thereof. Because, you know, this is the chemical potential of northbound, this is the chemical potential of the southbound ones. Now, what the probe, depending on its construction, might couple a lot better to this than to that. So, for example, let's say the probe happens to look something like this, you know, on a microscopic scale, something where if you're coming from this side, you just turn in gently. If you're coming from this side, it's real hard to get in. So what would happen then is that this probe would end up measuring this one rather than this one. Or it would be maybe 90% of this and 10% of that, things like that. So depending on the construction of the probe, now this is where, again, in big conductors, what happens is this difference is so small that it's not worth talking about. It's a relatively small difference we're talking. Whereas in small conductors, again, if you're talking of big differences and then you measure like this, what could happen is you put two probes and the one on this side measures this and the one on this side ends up measuring that, let's say. Because, again, the microscopic construction, you don't have a whole lot of control, you just took what you got. Well, then you might conclude that although the current is flowing this way, the voltage is dropping the other way. Because here you are measuring a higher voltage than the on this side. You know, and then you might come to the conclusion you actually have a negative resistance. And people have actually measured that in many small devices. They end up, you know, measuring things that look like negative resistance. But doesn't mean you could use it to generate power or anything like that. This is just a four-probe measurement. It's an artifact of the measurement itself. It's just that you're measuring this rather than you're measuring, not measuring the same thing on both places. So, in this context then, at that time, Boutiquer had proposed a very nice way of calculating resistances that could be compared to experiment and so on. And that's kind of the basis of this scattering theory of transport. And what I wanted to illustrate is how that works. And we'll kind of first do it with two probes meaning where we are just talking of two contacts, current flows, and we are talking of this voltage and the current. And then, but the real power of this is when you go to four probe measurements or multi-probe measurements, when there are many probes and the other probes are not necessarily non-invasive. So that's when this is really useful. So, but let's first see how it works for a two probe thing. So the basic thing that I want to write down first is, let's keep this expression up here. Let me write it here so we'll have this. I is equal to Q over H M T. So this is kind of motivated by this expression. So I is equal to this is that same expression that we had up there. And as I explained, this is like the number of channels, this is like the transmission. And so this is what I'm calling M, that's what I'm calling transmission, T, MT, whole thing. And you could write current as, I guess this is what I'm calling M over H. That's just because, as I said, later on we'll talk about how this is actually ends up being an integer and so on. And in general, you have to do some averaging over energy, but I'm assuming that these are those average numbers, whatever that is. Okay, so that's it. Okay. Now, what you could do is something like this, that so in the scattering theory of transport, the point is you do not talk about what goes on inside, but rather try to look at things from the terminals. So you say, okay, if at the terminals I have a situation like this, how is the terminal conditions here and here related. That's what the scattering matrix does. Relates the terminal and never really tells you anything about what goes on inside. You don't get into that directly. So you could write something like this, for example, that, so I've got 1 and 2, I1 Now, this is where I'm changing the notation a little compared to what we had been doing before. So it's important to be clear on this. Otherwise, this will mess you up later. So let me stress this point. Okay. Now, usually we have been talking of this channel as positive channel and this channel as negative channel, which made good sense. You know, after all, there's one that goes plus C, another that goes minus C. Okay. But when writing in terms of the scattering matrices, it is more convenient to call everything that comes in as, say, positive, and everything that goes out as, say, negative. Because you'll eventually have probes that are like here. So when you have just things going in one direction, okay, you could call this plus and this minus. But then when you go upwards, you have to give it some other name, L, R, etc. But if you say that everything that comes in is plus and everything that goes out is minus, that's the definition that works even if you have 100 probes. I mean, at every probe, whatever comes in is plus, whatever goes out is minus. So when people talk about scattering matrices, and this is also widely used in microwave theory or people when they're doing electromagnetic waves, waveguides, all kinds of things. It is most convenient to have this. So here, for example, I would write, this would be I1 plus. This is what comes in. What goes back is I1 minus. So this is like what we had before. The place where it reverses is at the other end. So at the other end, normally what comes in, I would have called I2 minus. After all, it's going this way. But now I'm going to call it I2 plus. And call this I2 minus. Why? Because plus is anything that comes in. Minus is anything that goes out. Okay? So this is where I'm reversing notation. Okay? That ordinarily, I'd have said, because previously whatever I've been doing, I'd have called this I2 plus, because this was just the same channel going to the plus C direction. But in S matrices, it's convenient to turn that around. Okay. So based on that, the equation I'm writing is that I1 minus, so that's this. What comes back here? Well, it's the reflection coefficient from here. So whatever came in, how many got reflected? And then whatever came in from here, how many got transmitted? So R I1 plus plus T I2 plus. And this is what you could write in matrix notation as I minus is equal to R, T, T, R, I plus. And this is what you'd then call the scattering matrix. So I plus tells you, I'm writing this in matrix notation now. So I plus means this is what I'm really writing here is this column vector. In fact, let me write this out so you see it. This is I1 plus. I2 plus. This is I1 minus, I2 minus. So whatever I wrote up here in matrix notation would look like that. Yeah.
Does this fulfill the reciprocity condition which normally is associated with scattering matrices? Like if you go from one end, you get the same thing out as you go from one end to the other.
Yeah. So this would, no, but this would have to do with the properties of this S matrix. So for example, I wrote here T and I wrote here T. Question is that, and of course the way I've written it, it would satisfy reciprocity, right? Now, under certain conditions, those two may not be equal, and I'll explain when. But that's a very important point. One reason I'm bringing this up also is that there are certain general rules for these S matrices that have to be satisfied in order to get consistent answers. And if you just write down something that doesn't, you'll get all kinds of wrong things. Okay. But so this is like what you'd call the S matrix, and it relates the incoming to the outgoing, for example. So from here, what we want to do is get a conductance matrix. And conductance means you're trying to relate current to voltage. Now, question is, what is current? Well, current is the difference between plus and minus. So you see, what we have here is I minus is equal to S times I plus. That's the basic equation we have. And what we'd like to do is get an equation for I equals something times V. So then this is what we could call the admittance or conductance matrix. That's what you really want. Now, what's I? Well, that's like I plus minus I minus. Because I at any terminal, you look at what goes in and what comes back out. Look at the difference, that's the current. Here, here, doesn't matter where you are. Any place, net current is what goes in minus what comes back out. That's current. And the voltage, that's like, that you have a choice of how to define it. You could, if you want to, you could call this the voltage. It is a measure of what is the chemical potential right there. So it would be proportional to I plus, for example. So this would be proportional to I plus, but we'll have to talk about what the proportionality is, and that we'll do on Monday properly. But the point is then, starting from here, what we'll do next day is try to get an expression for the conductance matrix from the S matrix. So S matrix is what you can write down kind of intuitively. Okay, how many coming in here actually get there, type of thing. And then with some simple algebra, you can get the conductance matrix. And once you understand how it works for two terminals, the same matrix equations work for, you know, four terminals or 100 terminals, makes no difference really. After that, I mean, the algebra gets complicated, but it's the same basic thing. Okay? So that's what we'll be doing on Monday.